SBC Media.
Welcome to the iGaming Daily Podcast, analysing the news from the betting and gaming industry all over the globe, supported by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming market.
For a second consecutive week, there have been developments concerning UK gambling's regulatory future. Last Monday, Parliament hosted its long-anticipated debate on affordability checks, showcasing a raft of distinct opinions on the Gambling Review's most divisive matter. As attention now turns to the Gambling Commission's imminent two-tier pilot scheme for financial risk checks, the debate revealed genuine worries from the UK racing industry about the future of a heritage sport that is so reliant on betting for its survival. The week also saw the Gambling Commission deliver the first datasets of its new survey methodologies measuring gambling prevalence in the UK. And to round off the week, and indeed February, the Betting and Gaming Council staged its annual general meeting, which provided the perspective of key political actors on delivering change to future-proof gambling, during which UK gambling stakeholders were warned of their wider duties beyond affordability checks. I'm Martin Elliott, and welcome to today's edition of iGaming Daily, brought to you in partnership with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming market. 56% of the EGR Power 50 personalised player experiences with Optimove, and as a special offer, Optimove is offering new clients a free first month when they buy Optimove. For more information and to claim the free month, go to optimove.com/SBC. Joining me today to discuss another busy week in UK gambling is SBC's content director, Ted Menmuir. Hi, Ted. How are you?
Very well, Martin. Good to have another rift on UK gambling's regulatory future.
Yeah.
Let's hope there's no part three, please.
Yeah.
We don't want to
Would you like a slight week,
please?
Yeah. Would you like a slightly quieter working week this week rather than you had?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, right, where shall we start? How about that Westminster Hall debate last Monday, which seemed quite lively? And frankly, I got the impression reading through the minutes of it, it was like a Quantum Leap episode from the Cameron Osborne years with Chris Grayling, IDS, Stephen Crabb, Adam Afrey, Matt Hancock, all pitching in. It was like like politics before Brexit.
It was, I know. And it was kind of a flashback to that era. And quite a stellar cast of MPs turning out for the debate, which is a good thing. And I think, you know, it does carry kind of a status that needs to be debated.
Yeah, I mean, is it really interesting? Some, you know, as you say, there were big hitters there, and there was some genuine debate going on. There's a lot goes on in Westminster that is just for show, but there were some pretty strong disagreements going on. There were some from, you know, they range from let's not have affordability checks at the one end to, you know, an accusation that the gambling industry was trying to use the future of racing to leverage out the affordability checks because it suited them. So, and then, you know, a number of opinions sort of midway between as well. It was really interesting stuff, I thought.
Yeah. I mean, you know, from reading the minutes and actually observing the video of the debate, I mean, what comes through is that none of the camps are really kind of moving on the matter. But the reality is that on affordability checks is that they're here to stay, and that it will come down to the UKGC's pilot program. And I think, I mean, you know, writing last week, I think that we have reached a key pillar or a key platform that is going to kind of oversee the future of UK gambling. And there's a lot riding on these tests, on this pilot program, because I just don't think it's about affordability checks in itself. I also think that it's the kind of foundation of where they will base all the kind of regulatory elements of the preceding consultations. So this is It's big for the UK Gambling Commission, but it's big for all the parties involved.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating to see whether these affordability checks work in practice. You know, in theory, it's been quite well thought out. There's a lot of preparation gone into this, but I still think there are some practical issues they've got to sort out. And I do fear that racing could be a bit of a casualty on this, because racing depends almost entirely on the gambling industry for its income and its survival, because most of its sponsorship comes from there, and then there's the levy mm-hmm. that helps to fund it as well. And traditionally, you know, the big bets, the big action in betting in the UK has been on racing. So, you know, they're going to have a greater number of people who are horse racing bettors a greater proportion of horse racing bettors will be affected by these, I think, than, say, football bettors or tennis bettors. So, you know, there is definitely a big risk for the racing industry if these don't work as smoothly as the Gambling Commission hope they do.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things about the debate, and that it did come through, that there is a genuine concern for racing. But it's also, I think the thinking here is, how do you kind of govern racing and govern kind of its interplay and relationship with UK gambling? And can it get to a better place, or can it rely less on betting? And again, also the importance of UK racing to rural constituencies.
Yeah.
So you saw so many MPs like Matt Hancock come out. You know, they all kind of came out with these lines of like representing their racetracks, representing their local stables, that yeah. it isn't just a case that British racing is a sport, but it's also that it has kind of a rural connection. It has values that are for the heritage of the UK. It's got a cultural aspect to it. And they really don't want to lose that. And it would be harmful to the UK on the whole, and a detriment if racing takes an impact. And again, this is where it comes down to, how well can these affordability checks be implemented, and how intrusive they will be.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the other big thing to note, the UK, the racing industry, it's not just about tradition. It's not just about a great day out. And, you know, going to the races is a great day out. One of the best things you can do, in my view anyway. It's a huge employer in rural economies where, you know, farming jobs don't pay that well and so on these days. The hunts of to all intents and purposes gone. So a lot of jobs, and, you know, some of the better paid jobs, although maybe stable lads would tell you differently, you know, really depend on this being done well and this working for the industry. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, they need a big rethink about how they're going to bring in the prize money and the sponsorship and so on that they need. So,
but there is a regret here for everyone involved, mm-hmm. is that we're now in year four, and I think that this has been, or last week was, the deepest debate we've had on regulating UK gambling, but also its cause and effect on stakeholders, and one of them being UK racing. And I think a lot of people will be thinking, like, this might be just too late down the field to kind of change the course or get a better consensus on what should be done to regulate the industry without harming other stakeholders involved.
Yeah, I think so. I think we should perhaps reflect when all this has gone through and so on. And I think, I'm trying to think who it was, is he called Danny Kruger? The guy who's, I think he's Prue Leith's son, isn't he? Who's a Conservative MP. And he raised the view in the debate that, you know, the people who are, and the stakeholders who are most affected by decisions in policy aren't really part of the process in forming that policy. So I think we should reflect after this, why has it taken the racing industry to come in and force this debate? And like, as you say, it's in year four we're having it. You know, why was this not happening closer to the start when it became? I think if you'd said at the start of this regulatory process, what are the absolute nailed on things that will come in as a result of the review, you'd have said, you know, stake limits on slots were pretty much guaranteed, and affordability checks were pretty much guaranteed as well. So it's a fair question for everyone to ask, and for stakeholders to ask, particularly racing that's so badly or is likely to be badly affected by it. Why haven't we had this discussion earlier? And, you know, why were they not? I know we've had a lot of consultations and so on, but have they been consulted enough, I guess?
Yeah, and I think, look, you said something very important, that you have to kind of separate the consultations from an actual debate. Hmm. So consultations are part of the process of how they review the proposals that they want to integrate into UK gambling. But one of the things that I kind of picked up on is that MPs such as Hancock and Matt Hancock and Davis, they made a clear statement that, yes, these are measures that are meant to kind of protect the players, but they're two very different things, stake limits and affordability checks. And I think even with Philip Davis, what he was saying was that affordability as proposed is intrusive and it's just not going to work with what the Gambling Commission is proposing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's got a point there as well. I do have some doubts about whether it'll work. It's a well-intentioned measure. There's no getting away from that. You know, the intention is right. They've listened. The people who've put this together have listened to what was said in the consultation. I just wonder if it's just an issue to which there is no frictionless solution. There's no solution that won't be intrusive and won't be damaging to some of the stakeholders.
I'm going to kind of fast track to the AGM and something that Bridget Simmons said, and the worry there that if you implement bad practices, it isn't that, you know, it's just bad for the consumer. It's just the impact, the wider impact is that you start to get a deficient market where kind of the threats and risks seem to get kind of momentum and your consumer is more exposed to the black market. So case in point, we've seen this in Germany where, yes, the cracks start, but then 2 years down the line, your exposure goes up to 20-30%. And again, this is an aspect that didn't get debated. I mean, what happens? How do you deal with deficiencies in the market post-regulation? And did we as an industry put that forward to the Gambling Commission? I mean, we yet to see the consultations responses, but that's one area that I will want to check on.
Sure. That will be interesting to look at. So just before we get into the break, perhaps we can just move on very slightly and have a look at the first round of the new gambling prevalence survey under the new methodology. Some interesting data in that, do you think, Ted?
I think the first data set has been on gambling prevalence. And it was very much the UKGC telling us, look, we're going to apply a new model. Now, I think the data set will be expanded as it touches upon the kind of the bigger threats, the bigger risks of UK gambling. But I think for now, they'll kind of focus the first data sets on UK gambling prevalence. And actually, there's not much to kind of take away from there that hasn't been previously reported on UK gambling participation amongst adults.
Yeah. I mean, one thing which struck me a little bit was that retail is or you know in-person gambling is so strong. You know, we're often, you know, I probably don't read the data and so on as much as I should do on this, and I rely on newspaper reports and so on. And you'd be forgiven for thinking there's some kind of pandemic of online gambling, but actually, these figures tell a different story to that. What I was most taken about was the question, reasons for gambling, which some of it was, you know, 86% of people said they did it to win big money. So I would suggest, 85.5% of people are quite disappointed when they're with their gambling. But there were a couple of other slightly bizarre things in this. 19% of people said they gambled for the mental challenge. And 44% said they gambled because it gave them a sense of achievement. So there you go. If you're looking for an excuse in future for putting a bet on, Ted, it's the mental challenge and the sense of achievement you get from it.
Oh, well.
Yeah. So anyway, let's just go into the break and a message from our sponsor. And when we come back, we will talk about the Betting and Gaming Council's annual general meeting.
SBC Leaders connects the gambling industry's top-tier operators and associations to share the best ideas, collaborate on solving the biggest issues, and push innovation throughout the betting and gaming industry. If you're an operator and want to join the discussion, visit sbcleaders.com for more information.
Okay, welcome back to part two of the iGaming Daily. And Ted, I was struck by something you wrote last week, which normally when I'm recommending something that one of the SBC team has written on this podcast, I can do it without worrying about sounding too sycophantic. It's somebody who's not on with me, but actually, but you're here today. I thought your report from the Betting and Gaming Council's annual general meeting was fascinating. There were some really interesting nuggets in there. For people who have made the mistake of not reading your report on it, Ted, who was there? Who was taking part in this meeting?
Okay, well, thank you. yeah, look, I mean, the Betting and Gaming Council had their annual general meeting, and the attendance was all the key political actors. So, yeah. You had Stuart Andrew, DCMS Undersecretary, but at the same time you had the Shadow Minister for Labour.
I have to say, I hadn't actually, this probably says more about me than her activity, but I'd not heard of Stephanie Peacock before.
Stephanie Peacock, thank you.
Yeah, first time she'd crossed my radar, really.
And also it was, well, the Betting and Gaming Council, they're going through a transition too. So it was Michael Duggar's last statement as CEO as he transfers over to chairman. And Bridget Simmons, who is the inaugural chair of the BGC, is leaving the industry. So it was good to kind of get their perspectives too about what they feel the trade body's doing, about their short-term and long-term output. And also from Bridget Simmons' standpoint of how the debate changed and the priorities of the BGC have been formed, and also where she kind of sees the debate heading towards.
Yeah, I thought she had a really interesting point about operators in the industry almost being the potential for them to be frozen out of decisions about how the incoming mm-hmm. levy is spent on research, education and treatment. You know, I think it will be a real shame if the expertise from the industry is not part of that process.
Yeah. But, I mean, going back to the AGM, I mean, it was another good event with a good basis and grounding of how conflicting it is to regulate this industry and what is at stake, who, you know, what we're trying to protect, who are the stakeholders. And again, you know, you just, you left there thinking, well, guys, this is 4 years down the line. And, you know, you had Andrew Rhodes' statements, and he underscored that, look, throughout he's reached the third year of his tenure as CEO, and at no point, you know, if you look back since the UKGC was established in 2005, there's never been kind of any detriment to growth. And yeah, he asked the kind of a prominent question. He was like, what do you guys expect from a regulator? And where do we kind of stand against you guys not being able to kind of achieve what your businesses want to do within kind of the regulatory remit of gambling?
Yeah, I think looking through your report on this, you raised some interesting, some pertinent points, really, about how things like return to player has dropped across a number of products, but profits have still carried on going up. So what does that mean? You know, what can the industry really expect the regulator to do, or what do they expect a regulatory regime to give them? Which is an interesting point. And another thing I thought he, which I thought was interesting, was when he talked about moving the commission's focus onto what he described as tier 2, 3, and 4 operators, and really having a look at their operations and, you know, the compliance or otherwise in those businesses. That's a bit of a change, because we see a lot of headlines if a tier 1 operator is hit with a penalty, but we don't hear quite so much about the smaller players in the market.
Mm-hmm. But then another thing that Andrew Rhodes and the UKGC underlined is that they do want a depth of market and a depth of choice in how UK gambling is structured, because they view that that is essential kind of provision against the black market. That if you're a consumer, you've got quite a vast number of operators that you can choose from, that they have some innovations to put forward to you, and that, you know, your offer isn't just here's a bonus, sign up, and you can play on 7 regulated sites as we've seen in other European markets.
Sure. I mean, that's I think there's some sense to that approach, isn't there? Although every time you tighten regulation, it does benefit the bigger players, I think. It does become more difficult for those without the funds and the infrastructure and to employ more compliance staff and so on to fit in with it.
But there's actually a thinking here, and I was speaking to a number of attendees at the AGM, and they said, look, actually, if you are a, you know, operationally effective small size to mid size online gambling operator, especially strong on the casino element, where, you know, yes, you might say the bigger guys have resources, right? But they're not exactly getting it right. I mean, they're still spending multi-millions, you know, in expenses year on year. And a lot of, you know, a lot of people were saying that if you are an effective small-sized operator, UK-focused, and you are good on the compliance end, and you are good on onboarding players, and you're very effective at the operational procedures needed to be compliant, you're going to get acquired, and you're going to get acquired at quite a big multiple. So it isn't like, it, you know, just compliance is just going to kill the market. I think now it's about the kind of the adaptability of the operators, right, and who's kind of standing in the next 3 years.
Yeah. I guess that if you use that sort of thinking as well, it still opens up the floor for the what you might call a specialist operator, somebody who can carve out a genuine niche, whether that be taking on the high rollers or, you know, specializing in American sports or just being a pure play live casino or whatever it might be, the market will provide an opportunity if you do it well, I guess, is the outcome mm-hmm. of that thinking, which is great news for players. Because, you know, while the tier one operators do a really good job for a recreational punter, someone like me, who just wants to stick a few quid on the football and, you know, the occasional big race or whatever. If you are a bit of a more considered player, you know, you have a particular specialism in mind, the tier ones don't always really meet those needs. Looking at it purely from a player's point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. One other thing that interested me was the aforementioned Stephanie Peacock turning up at the meeting. Did she give any hints as to what Labour's thinking about this might be? Because, you know, there's an opinion poll out today, which if you put it into the UK polling report model, says that Labour are going to get 454 seats at the next election.
Yeah.
So let's say they have a good chance of forming the government. So what they think on this is quite important.
So, yes, good on the BGC to get the shadow minister's views.
Yeah.
And as Stephanie Peacock said, look, there is kind of consensus across political ranks on that gambling needs reforms. One thing that she underlined is that any reform that Labour do on a high-risk sector is pulled back against the UK consumer living through a period of high inflation and a cost of living crisis. And she mentioned that twice in her speech, that, look, you guys are going to get regulated, but our thinking is always about, is it fair on what the consumer is going through and what the consumer is living? And, you know, talking about a fair market, she did raise the point that Labour believes it's unfair that the National Lottery has been left out of safer gambling duties, and that they need to be involved.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, because that's been missing from this conversation for quite some time, really, hasn't it? And I know that a number of people I speak to in the at operators are quite annoyed about that the National Lottery can get away with things that, you know, apply huge costs to them. And, you know, people really hate people in the industry, a lot of them hate those adverts, the lottery, where they can say, come on, you can change your life if you gamble with us. Obviously, everyone else is highly regulated what they can and can't say in their adverts. But, you know, the safer gambling provisions is a more important point than that, I guess. But, you know, I thought it's a positive, quite encouraging that they've thought about that where the current government hasn't. But, so any conclusion you wanted to reach from the BGC meeting? Or...
it's been an interesting month to kind of reflect back on. A lot of developments coming in February, and look, at least we're getting some clarity on the UK gambling's regulatory future. And look, these player protection measures are here to stay, but they're yet to be kind of out and out defined. We've got a key 6 months coming up for the industry. And again, going back to kind of affordability checks, I don't think that affordability checks will just be on the limits. I think that they are going to be kind of the foundation of how UK gambling proceeds with the rest of its agenda, or the rest of the white paper. Or white paper proposals. Yeah. And what turns out of this pilot test will also affect kind of the gambling levy, how that's structured. Because again, I think what we're at that period where we actually, you know, we're drilling down on the actual mechanisms and how they're going to be imposed. And again, what is feasible. And I think that once the regulator and the political actors know, like, you know, this is actually like a blueprint that we can put through, right? They can then start thinking about, look, what are the other kind of remaining elements of this review and how they shaped by affordability check as a protection on the consumer.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We are. It's nice that we've got some kind of resolution or something concrete to go on. But yeah, you're right. First step on a. Sorry, I'm going to sound quite cliched, like somebody who's just been voted off Strictly Come Dancing now, to talk about the journey we've been on through this. And, you know, it is the first step on a longer journey, I think. I guess we can probably revisit this on March the 5th next year and see where we're up to. And we'll still be talking about it, I imagine. But thanks for joining me today, Ted. And despite the technical issues we've had along the way, we've got through it finally, I think. So
thank you.
Thanks for listening, and come back and join us again for another episode of iGaming Daily tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to today's iGaming Daily podcast, supported by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming market. If you want to find out more about some of the subjects raised today, feel free to explore any of the sites in the SBC News Network or check out the latest edition of the SBC Leaders magazine. Happy reading.